This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Peacekeepers to Punishers, the police force in speculative fiction.
Now, this is an episode that we thought about doing a little while ago, but I think we've both held off on it.
Yeah, we actually decided, we talked about doing it last September, and considering other things that were occurring at the time, it seemed a bit insensitive, even though we weren't really touching on those issues, so
yeah,
we pushed it back. There are obviously other issues going on, but it's beyond the scope of this episode to really talk about real-life policing, other than how it intersects and is used in fantasy and science fiction.
Yeah.
So we're not going to get all political. We're going to avoid it as much as possible.
Yeah. I mean, I think... Look, there may be some sort of bleeding into it, just within reference to the topic at hand.
Yeah.
I think the reason we've said, right, we're finally going to do it, but it's a difficult topic, I think, for a lot of people. And we'll just address this now so that we can just get on with it, in that, you know, people have very mixed feelings about the police. A lot of people feel quite betrayed or even scared of them. So, yeah, we appreciate that for some people this might be a topic which you don't really want to engage with. And as we said, we are looking at it very much in terms of speculative fiction. And we're going to try and avoid talking too much about sort of the more real life issues which are occurring, because I think that that is a very, very heavy topic. One which a lot of people, you know, it induces a lot of anxiety for a lot of people.
Yeah, definitely. So, yes. While there's obviously lots of anger and other feelings going on, and that's all perfectly legitimate, we're trying to stay away from it. Having said that, if you feel that this is going to touch too much on something that's a bit of a hot button for you, you obviously don't have to listen. We'll be back again next week with something else.
Absolutely. Priority is that you don't, you know, feel anxious or upset by content, and we obviously don't mind if you don't listen to every single one of our episodes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. The other thing we should say, it's a slightly lesser concern actually, is that because of the nature of how we're looking at this, books and films and things that have been out for sort of about 4 years, we will be being quite spoilery in places, or potentially we could be. So
yeah.
Again, look at the list of things that are going into this episode and decide whether you want to be spoiled or not.
Yes.
if it was something that was out in the last year, I'm going to try and steer clear of any spoilers. But otherwise, it's kind of fair game.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, with that in mind, let's throw ourselves into the episode, shall we?
Yes, let's do that. okay, so I suppose one thing to address is why this episode in the first place. And I think it was largely me sort of originally pushing for this, but it was partly, I think it comes out of the fact that I do quite selectively really like crime. I like crime drama and things. And when it's done well in speculative fiction, it's kind of like, you know, it's almost like a chef's kiss combination for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree, and I do really enjoy sort of police dramas. I always have. Now, putting aside the whole propaganda angle of sort of the origin of the police drama, and we'll sort of talk a little bit about the history of that in a minute, there is just, I mean, it's a formula that works, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of mystery or thriller or human interest, it combines all of those things and something more, quite often something historical as well.
Yeah.
And it just hits you on so many levels, and done well with, you know, decent characterization and dialogue and things. It just, there's almost something there for everyone. I mean, I hear a lot of people say, oh, I don't like crime. And yet then they'll tell me that they like watching CSI Miami or something like that. And I'm like, you do realise that's crime, right? Like, what you mean is you don't like crime in this format about this stuff, but actually crime is a huge, huge genre.
It really is. I mean, like, I do remember at one point also saying, I'm not that into crime. And then my mother just sort of looking over me, over the top of her glasses, like, Madeline, you've watched every single episode of Poirot that's ever existed. And I'm like, that's detective fiction. Leave me alone.
So, yeah, it's one of those things, like we've said before when we did an episode on romance, and, you know, lots of people don't like romance, but actually you find your gateway with romance, and you probably find this romance you do actually like. It's just you wouldn't think of it as romance.
Yeah.
And it's the same with crime. There's a reason those two genres are the biggest selling genres, I think.
Yeah. And I absolutely want to point out that you can enjoy crime fiction and enjoy the kind of the whole the buddy cop thing and things like that without excusing that kind of behaviour. Like, it's perfectly fine if you're watching, you know, I watched Elementary. I really, really enjoyed Elementary. And they would frequently break into people's houses. And same with House. I know House isn't technically a crime, but it's the whole centre of it is, obviously it's based off of Sherlock Holmes. And they would frequently break into people's houses. Now, on a TV show, you're like, yeah, absolutely, they need to get that evidence in order to save a life. In real life, not so much. So it is okay to appreciate fiction from reality.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think obviously the thing is the way that the fiction for police procedurals is packaged, it's so that it's interesting for you, because let's be honest, if you followed an actual policeman through their day, you'd find it quite boring, because most of it is quite boring. It's a long, laborious process.
There's a lot of paperwork involved.
And when, you know, I love forensics, I find it fascinating, but it's never one person who makes all the discoveries and cracks the case. It's usually a team of lots of different people all working in their specialities.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's packaged differently for fiction, and it has to be, I think, because otherwise it would be so slow, nobody would be on board.
Yeah, absolutely. I think probably one of the... one of my favourite pieces of fiction, sort of police drama, is Hot Fuzz, because it actually
that actually kind of encapsulates British policing to a certain extent, except you've got this guy, it's beautifully done, it's the idea that he's too effective in the city, so they palm him off to the middle of bloody nowhere. And it's like, he can't do much. It looks like all he's going to be able to do is hunt down this missing swan.
Yeah, there's just this swan which is literally swanning about. And that is a legitimate thing that really does happen.
Oh, God,
In British... British
missing livestock randomly turning up in people's gardens. We've had all sorts, cows, cart horses.
Yep.
Yeah. It's all good fun living in the country in Britain.
I mean, I'm fairly sure there was a recent news story about people trying to herd swans out of Bath train station. So, you know, honestly, that's a reality. Where we live.
There's that town in Wales near the mountains. I think it's near the Cambrian Mountains, actually. Mm-hmm. And during lockdown, everything went so quiet that the goats came down out of the mountains and started grazing in gardens and on the flower beds and things in the public parks. And there's all this footage of these random herds of goats just wandering around. It's kind of like, the apocalypse has come and the goats have inherited the earth.
It was great, because in France, it wasn't just goats, it was wild boar.
Yeah.
Just running through the streets. If you've ever met a wild boar, they're really scary.
The thing is, you don't stick around to shake trotters with them, because they're just not massively friendly.
No, they don't want to be your friend. Like lots of wild animals, they do not want to be your friend. So yeah, so that's what sort of police reality is, I guess, in some places. And yeah, so obviously it does need to be dressed up differently in order to be interesting in fiction. And because of that, it does have the right ingredients for all sorts of really interesting stuff, which has then fed into other genres because it's such a winning combination.
Yeah, absolutely. And as Madeline was talking about, you know, there's a historical aspect to it. When you write something that is basically SFF, but crime or police procedural particularly, it's drawing on this rich heritage of police procedurals, vintage noir, gumshoe, flatfoot detective fiction.
And
you know, crime dramas. So much this because it's such a popular drama, because we are immersed with it, even if you don't seek it out and watch it. It's created these chains of association that are then easy for science fiction fantasy authors to draw on without having to do massive amounts of world building.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So let's actually have a kind of a little bit of a look at some of the ingredients which make it so successful.
Yeah, definitely. A big one for me is the fact that when you have a, for lack of a better term, we'll call them a police character. Mm-hmm. I mean, it could be anything. Whatever your police force is called, the watch or, you know, the dogs or whatever you call them in your book. Generally, your main character is someone who's going to have to face deep moral quandaries. And that's the nature of the beast, the job, because you are closest to the best and the worst of humanity. And in order to be an effective police officer, you need to understand that, which means you need to be someone who understands and recognises within themselves that they have the capability to be just as dishonest and violent under different circumstances.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So you get this really interesting sort of seesaw thing, and usually all the way through a police procedural type series, whereby you don't know quite which way a character's going to go. And quite often they will do a few things that are a little bit crooked to advance their end. And it's when the balance shifts from, yeah, actually the ends did not justify the means.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, I think that this is when you have a successful sort of police drama or crime fiction, is when that is addressed, when there is a line of addressed whereby the policeman is in a position of power. And I say policemen, they're in a position of power and they have to consider what they use their power for. And also reflect that actually they might be part of a system which doesn't always do good. What I don't tend to like is when you have police dramas where no matter what they do wrong, there's never any kind of sense of consequence, growth, or consideration.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You get less of that now, I think.
You do. It became a bit of a hot thing a few years ago. And by a few years ago, I mean more than just a couple of years ago. It was a hot thing. And again, I think that there was a sort of element of propaganda tied to that. And we have thankfully steered away from it now in looking at things of, okay, actually, you know, people are complicated. The thing that always really gets me is that you always see the policemen as these hyper-intellectual, from the upper echelons of society kind of characters, like they come from a very rich background, they listen to a whole lot of opera and stuff like that. And I'm not saying that's not possible, I'm not saying that the Morse character isn't believable or credible or anything like that. I like Morse very much. I'm saying that it does often make me laugh when you just see this entire police force in these certain series of books who are all just these very sort of this one particular kind of character, and I'm like, really? Really? Only this guy?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's kind of like, as a parallel, people writing books where the character is, let's say it's set in a medieval world, the character is always a prince or a princess or a nobleman or, you know, someone who is going to become that at some point. And yeah, it's the same with a lot of crime type stuff. you generally get someone who is, you know, they've come through, come to law enforcement through having a degree.
Yeah.
Not everybody does. I mean, if you fast track up to sort of detective inspector, you know, senior detective inspector, all the way up to sergeant, etc.
Yeah.
You probably do need to have a degree, and probably an advanced degree.
Yeah.
Because you just would not be able to get through that quickly. They have exams for all of these. Certainly in the UK, they have exams for all of these things. I presume it's the same in America, but I don't actually know. So, yeah, and I guess people gravitate towards it because they think, yeah, there's more to go on. Mm-hmm. But actually, I'm quite interested in the characters where clearly they've learned everything kind of on the streets as well. And some of them have even started off life as in, you know, as a youth, I was one of the ones sort of vandalising things and nicking stuff from shops, etc. And stealing cars. And then I kind of got a bit of a wake-up call before I turned 18 and went into the police force. That's an interesting storyline.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And again, we're talking about fiction. We're not talking about reality. We're talking about fiction.
Yeah. although it does happen, but yeah, we are
talking about fiction. It absolutely does happen. And again, I think something that Jules and I also have to mention is that our experience of the police and stuff like that is obviously very much based in the UK. I'm not saying that the UK police don't have their issues, because there is still definitely some stuff there. But one thing I will say is that certainly in the UK, the requirements you need to become a police officer are larger and the training is longer than in the US.
Yeah, there's that. There's also the fact that if you want to be an armed officer, you are required to pass some very stringent tests and exams, and then you have to retest every 3 months.
Yeah.
You cannot carry a firearm without that. You need special permission. So it seems to be a bit of an automatic thing where, you know, you get your badge and your gun in America. I don't want to criticise someone else's housekeeping, but giving someone something that makes it much easier to kill someone in a moment when they're frightened seems a really, really bad idea to me.
Yeah.
And particularly since most police officers in America then have to pay for a lot of their own extra training in order to get anywhere near competent. So I'm with the UK model. We had Dunblane, where there was that terrible school shooting. It happened once and that was it. Handguns were banned.
Yeah.
And that is how it should have happened. You know, that's all I'm going to say about it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Again, when I'm very aware that there are issues with the police in the UK and just institutions in general. And that Jules and I are also looking at this from the point of view of two white people, you know, in the UK, which means our experience will automatically be different anyway. So we both recognise that. But back to the fiction side of things again.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I do really, really enjoy it when you have these characters who face these moral quandaries. And I think that one of the reasons that it works so well is that it is a, you know, a hyper version of the reality that people face every day in terms of saying, I'm always in a position of power over somebody else in some shape or form. And I have the power to do bad things, even if I won't necessarily get caught. I have the power to do bad things, or I have the power to make someone else's life a little bit difficult, or I have the power to just to rule over somebody in some way. And I think the reason that it's so popular in fiction is because people kind of like to see that part of themselves, that own moral quandary that we face in our day-to-day. Sort of on screen, but in a more extreme sort of circumstance. And it's a conversation about the human condition, I think.
Yeah, definitely. There is most police officers in real life as well, and it's certainly reflected in fiction, most of them are aware that the law is imperfect.
Yeah.
It's what we've got, and it can always be improved. and it's a lengthy, laborious process in order to get the law improved. So usually that means that in order to get a law improved, someone has fallen down the cracks and it's failed somebody. And that is really, really unfortunate, especially if it's you that it's failed. But unfortunately, that is the way it kind of needs to be at the moment, because when you try and rush through and change the law is when you end up with things like almost like a military police state, or swift transfers of power, or people refusing to leave positions of authority when they've been deemed unfit for them, for example.
Or when they've been voted out.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, there's a reason these things take time and they're laborious, but that doesn't change it for the average, you know, the average copper who's kind of like, it's imperfect and this is kind of bollocks, but I've got to uphold even this bit as well. Even though this means chasing down a petty criminal who's not actually doing any real harm.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And you generally find that most of them are relatively reasonable. I mean, I've known a lot of police officers. There's only one I can think of who I'm like, yeah, I know for a fact that it wouldn't matter if you saw someone as a criminal, and it wouldn't matter what colour they were or who they were or what their gender was, you would beat the living shit out of them.
Yeah.
And I know this for a fact because he took great delight in telling me this during a karate conference, so that was some fun.
That's terrifying.
Yeah, he wasn't much of a fighter in fairness, but anyway, that's a tangent we'll go off on another time. but, you know, there are people out there, and we'll get into why that is the case soon. Mm-hmm. But pretty much all the others that I've known and met, and because I worked in the NHS and various other things, I met lots over the years. Generally, they're just people trying to do a job. And as Madeline says, it's that extreme version of that quandary. It's understanding that the law is imperfect but needs to be upheld, and yet also being a human and understanding the personal need for justice as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the Javert sort of argument, isn't it? Where we're watching Les Misérables and we're just there like, okay, Javert, calm your tits, he stole a piece of bread. It's not like he murdered a man, and Javert's just there like, no, this bread thief will face justice. Like, that's extreme, Javert.
A bread thief that had actually already served 20 years of hard labour in a dry dock.
Yeah.
As well, because he broke his parole.
Yeah. It's extreme. And I just don't think that many people are like Javert. I do think there are some people who were tenacious against others, despite the smallness of their alleged crime. But I very much doubt that for those people who are, you know, who continue to pursue and harass people over small things, that they have justice in mind. I think that's just bullying, and it does definitely happen. And I think that, just as with any kind of job which allows people to be in a position of power, that includes teachers as well, social workers sometimes, police, it will attract bullies sometimes. And people who just want to basically kind of sort through their own issues by taking it out on other people. So I don't think justice is necessarily in their minds. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about when you have a character who is conscious of these things, and maybe really truly does believe in the justice system, but then every now and again has to question it. And that's one of my favourites, is when you get a character who's all very much, oh yes, the law is always right, you know, we must obey it. And then over time they start to really sort of consider the larger implications of, actually, is this right? Which is ultimately actually what happens to Javert when he turns around and goes, huh, maybe the law isn't always right. Maybe we shouldn't just be killing random children and people like that because they don't want to starve. This makes me uncomfortable. Death! And he just flings himself off a bridge. But that for me, is interesting.
There is also a certain amount of, okay, well, I've just been bested by the person I've spent 20 years of my life hunting down. So I'm going to throw his mercy back in his face because I can't stand it. I'm so inflexible in my beliefs.
Yeah.
Which makes him an interesting character, but you couldn't do much more with him from there because he had a moment of change and he chose not to change.
Yeah. Because I think it was that he had a moment of change and he just couldn't really deal with it. Because he just couldn't cope with being in a world where he was wrong, ultimately.
And not only was he wrong, he'd been wrong for 20 years. But yep. Yeah, there is very definitely lines in the book which says he determines that he's going to cast his Jean Valjean's mercy back in his face.
Yeah.
He spared my life, therefore I'm going to kill myself. not the best of motivations, in my opinion. But
that's on you, Javert. That's on you.
But anyway, sorry, getting back to speculative fiction, there's lots of good meat on the bones here for mm-hmm. something you want to do with a character. And you can do lots of different things with this. You know, by mixing the quantities, you can have a copper who is mostly on the take.
Yeah.
And suddenly something happens that makes them go, shit, oh God, you know, if you get me out of this alive, I swear I will be a really good cop after this. That's an interesting twist as well.
Yeah.
Or I've always been brought up to believe this doctrine, this dogma, and I've just realised that, like Javert, it might actually be wrong and I'm fighting for the wrong thing. And I've got an example of that we'll go into a bit later.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
This is the really popular one where you have the maverick character.
Everyone loves a maverick cop. Yeah. I mean, they're usually someone you want to bash into a wall.
Yeah, like, I should also just say, everyone loves a maverick in fiction. You would not want a maverick cop in person. Who basically, they're salt of the earth. They, you know, they genuinely care about people. And they'll do what needs to be done to do things. And fuck the bureaucracy, as if that, you know, there are certain things which don't protect people's rights, etc. No, but they'll do what needs to be done. And yeah, maybe every now and again they take some drugs. Maybe they, you know, sleep with prostitutes. Maybe they, etc. Maybe they do all these things which are technically illegal.
Well, and quite often you find they go in there and start exchanging fisticuffs with an actual criminal.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter that you feel that it's justified. The point is that person is entitled to rights to be treated like a human and not have the shit beaten out of them.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, yeah, maverick cop in fiction, loads and loads of fun, but generally they're also a dangerous loose cannon and their character arc is usually about them learning a measure of control or how to balance themselves with a better, slightly more rule embracing partner.
Yeah.
We're thinking of Lethal Weapon here, kind of,
aren't we? We are basically thinking of Lethal Weapon, yeah.
So, yes, loads of really good tropes, and we've almost touched on it, but the whole idea of friendship under fire. So in the same way we get with army and soldier-type films, where you have the bonds of friendship formed under extremely difficult circumstances, you get the same in a slightly different way. You know, the whole buddy cop thing.
Yeah, this is the weird thing, because I think the reason people like the whole buddy cop thing is that it's that ultimate found family sort of trope.
Yeah.
The reality is actually kind of scary, because the you always see that rhetoric in police dramas where they're like, they killed one of our own. We won't rest. And I'm just there like, why are you suddenly pulling all the stops out because one of your own got killed? Like, hundreds of civilians got killed, but no, it's because one of your own got killed. And also we protect our own. This is the rhetoric that also really gets me, is whenever you see in film series, and they do it in almost every long-standing cop series, where they have an internal investigator who turns up to basically say, there seems to be some corrupt stuff going on here, so I'm just going to investigate it. And everyone treats them like they are the ultimate enemy. And it's very much, you know, you're against us, we're a family, and you've come in to disrupt us. And I'm just there like, no, I'm with that guy.
Like, you're the outsider. Yeah, I think the whole sort of, well, they took one of our own thing is sort of understandable, because in some respects it's kind of, you know, I'm okay, let's say you're someone who genuinely is called to protect and serve, and that's what you believe you're doing.
Yeah.
And you're doing the job because you genuinely believe you can help and you want to help. And what you spend a lot of your time doing is dealing with some of humanity's nastiest shit.
Yeah.
I can kind of get that. And then somebody stabs your mate for it. And it would be stabs over here, not guns, guys, generally.
Yeah.
So I get it. But you're right. The way it's played up in drama like that is disturbing because it sets this precedent that it's okay to go to all lengths if someone kills one of your mates. And it's absolutely not okay.
Yeah, but that's still understandable. And that's, I think, is the thing, is that, you know, we tend to think, if anyone did this to someone I love and know, I would go all out to get some kind of revenge. Absolutely. So, yeah. The whole buddy cop thing, it's just found families. And you know how we love found families.
Definitely. There's also, you know, different worlds and settings. You can require different laws and law enforcement, not to be confused with legal system, because weirdly, a legal system is completely different to law enforcement and law. It's a chance to examine, parody, and even lampoon sometimes something that's ridiculous in real life.
Yeah, absolutely. This, I don't want to derail this too much, but I do just want to talk about the Sons of Thestian here a little bit. When it comes to sort of the different worlds, the law system.
It's like, oh yeah, one curfew, otherwise you get eaten. You know, it's not that you're wrong, it's just kind of like, when I first read that book, I was kind of like, bloody hell, that's very broken windows policing, Madeline.
It is, it's meant to be very, very extreme. And it was meant to be terrifying, in its original conception, because that was the first part of the Hamartia cycle I ever came up with, was the night patrol, and just this idea that past a certain time you couldn't leave your homes because that's when the monsters came out. And then I thought, how much more scary would it be if the monsters were let out on purpose? And the really interesting thing for me is writing from Zachary's point of view. And being like, he didn't eat that many people, and everyone's like, no, but he still ate people, didn't he? He still led a bunch of people and ate, and then they ate other people. Like, that's a thing that definitely happened. But the thing with the Hamartia cycle is that Zachary was not breaking the law; he was following orders. Does that make what he did right? No, you should not eat people. You should not be enforcing what is essentially a dictatorship at this point, and killing people for breaking curfew. Now, historically, I'd like to point out, there have been curfews which have induced very, very, you know, stringent sort of laws if you're breaking the curfew, terrible punishments, including death. That is a thing that happened historically. So that is part of the reason why it happened. And as Zachary does later explain, he doesn't necessarily kill all the people who did curfew, because he's tried to convince himself that what he was doing was right, because he was only killing criminals. That's what he's told himself. And as Daniel points out to him, that very clearly at one point there were a bunch of children who were out after curfew, and Zachary, for some reason, didn't kill them. So it was a conscious decision that he was making. And it does bring into question the validity of, just because your king says it's so, doesn't necessarily make it right. And just because something is legal, or something is illegal, again, doesn't make it right. So just because it was illegal to be out after a certain time of night, doesn't mean that it was morally wrong to be out at a certain time of night. Just as, you know, there was a time where it was illegal to hide the resistance or the Jewish people. Yet we do not consider people who hid la resistance or the Jewish people during the Holocaust as criminals, do we?
No. Well, obviously we don't now, but would we have done if the Nazis had won?
Yes.
And they'd written history. So, you know, they would have definitely been dangerous radicals, wouldn't they?
Yes, exactly. So that was one of the big things that I wanted to look at. And something that can definitely be addressed very much in fantasy is the idea of just because it's law doesn't make it right, essentially.
Yeah, definitely. So, let's look at some worlds and settings. I'm going to start off with a sort of medieval setting,
mm-hmm.
Mostly because I want to talk about Terry Pratchett's Guards books, or the Watch books. A note here, I'm going to be talking about the books and not the series, and this is the last time I'm going to mention the series.
Okay. Just going to pretend that didn't happen, eh?
Make of it what you will, guys. Make of it what you will. I will. In fairness, I've not watched it, and I have no intention of doing so.
Right, got it.
The medieval setting. I mean, Terry Pratchett's Discworld is obviously a bit of a masterpiece, but you need to find your gateway book into it. And when I was trying to go in via the order they were written in, or, you know, the order that they're supposed to go in, I just kept getting thrown out again because it's wizards and they're basically bureaucrats, and it's, I found it really boring.
Yeah.
So then I tried some of the witch ones, and I liked the death books, and Alan banged on at me for ages until I tried Guards, which is very genuinely very, very funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of carried on and followed all the way through the Guards series of books within the entire Discworld series, and it's really interesting. You've got Sergeant Vimes, who, he's the watch captain, and you go in at Guards, and he's got jaded and disillusioned, and, you know, he's not keen of eye and quick of wit anymore. He drinks too much. He's run down. He's lonely. He's got a police department, effectively a watch department,
mm-hmm.
that basically consists of two incompetent underlings. And, you know, it's literally an unfunded police department.
Yeah.
And they suddenly get sent this sort of 19-year-old boy who was raised by dwarfs, who's clearly not a dwarf, but thinks of himself as a dwarf, despite being 6'5".
Mm-hmm.
Called Carrot. And Carrot's kind of like, ah, here you are, Sarge. He's all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and he's not stupid, he's just infallibly decent to the point where he cannot conceive of other people not being decent until he sees them doing something wrong. And he starts arresting everyone who does something even a little bit wrong, to the point where Vimes is kind of like, what are you doing? You're arresting thieves. He's like, oh, yeah, I know, Sarge, we're supposed to arrest thieves. Like, yeah, but you realise if you arrest all the thieves, there'll be nobody working in the Thieves Guild tonight, don't you? What are you going to do? Thank God you didn't actually arrest any assassins. The Assassins Guild would have brought this place down around our ears, kind of thing. But through the course of this, Vimes starts to wake up. He realises he's been relying on drink far too much. He never comes out and says he's an alcoholic. He doesn't put words like that on the page. But you're left in no doubt that he was fully in the grip of alcoholism,
mm-hmm.
and he makes the decision to quit about halfway through the book, and even a few books later it's still a bit of a struggle for him, but he's kept going with it.
Yeah.
And the light sort of goes back on in his eyes, and he starts thinking, actually, maybe we can make a difference. And as the books go on, he starts making changes to the watch, which, you know, gets him into trouble with the patrician to a certain extent and various other things. And the watch genuinely becomes a force for good. And it doesn't matter that some of them are absolutely bonkers or useless, because they're being really well led. And then it becomes very representational. And obviously Pratchett's taking on sexism and racism and things by having trolls and dwarves and a woman who turns out to be a werewolf joining the watch. Because they're all there talking in men-at-arms. It's like, well, we've got a troll and we've got a dwarf, and we're all supposed to get on together while we're working together. And then they eventually get a goblin, and Angu is there, and she's this statuesque blonde woman. It's like, I guess you must be the token woman. And she's like, yes! Not telling any of them that she's actually a werewolf. The point is, it's really well done. And it's funny, and it's played for laughs, definitely, but then it's played for laughs in a way that it can then hit you with bits of wisdom a little bit like this. And I've got a couple of tiny quotes that I'm just going to read out, because they are so apposite for today, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
This is from Snuff, which is one of the guards' books. There were times when the world did not need policemen, because what it really did need was for somebody who knew what they were doing to shut it all down and start it all up again, so that this time it could be done properly. This is things that Vimes is thinking.
Ooh, okay.
And then there's another one. You'll like this one. It's referencing Les Mis. Again, this is Vimes thinking to himself in Snuff, and he goes through a lot of what a policeman actually should become.
Mm-hmm.
But what should we do when the highborn and the wealthy take to crime? Indeed, if a poor man will spend a year in prison for stealing out of hunger, how high would the gallows need to be to hang the rich man who breaks the law out of greed?
Yup.
Yeah. And this one, which is from Nightwatch, which I particularly like. This is a bit of dialogue. It's like, he asked you to shoot at people who weren't shooting back, growled Vimes, striding forwards. They are throwing stones, Sarge, said Colon. So, stay out of range, they'll get tired before we do. And it's a lovely, you know, it's three lines on using justifiable force and when not to use it. And I don't think I've ever seen anybody else put that in quite such an eloquent way, and yet with so few words.
Yeah, that's great. Sorry, it makes me think of In Bruges.
Yes.
Just also that sorry, and I really do like that line, but the moment you said that, all I could think was In Bruges, when the one of the characters is asking the other one, you know, at what point, you know, where's the line for justifiable force? Like, at what point is he allowed to turn around and attack someone in response? It's like, you know, if someone comes at, you know, and they're sort of, it's like, what if someone comes at me with a bottle, and they're like, yeah, I mean, like, yeah, you get hit in the head with a bottle, that could kill you. So if someone, you know, tries to hit you in the head with the bottle, then you can sort of use justifiable force, which was effectual, and I'm not going to say inoffensive, but he looked at things the way that they were, and I really like how he mixed those into his, you know, into his world, like in the way that the witches are social workers, overworked, yeah, social workers,
and nurses, effectively, and nurses. They're sort of jack of all trades,
exactly.
But yeah, I mean, you read it and you can tell that when he's talking about genuine injustices and prejudice, that he's furious. You can tell he's really, really fucking angry. But he also subscribes to, you can't take someone kicking and screaming.
Mm-hmm.
You should lead them gently by the hand and they will go with you. And unless, you know, they're a dyed-in-the-wool asshole, they will genuinely start to see your point.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's how we are kind of wired. So, and, you know, prejudice is illogical, ultimately. So you need vast amounts of illogic to prop it up.
Yes.
Which is why, you know, you get your white supremacists and things, and they don't actually believe what they're saying. It's just an excuse for their actions.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Usually also because the moment their beliefs are questioned, they don't bear up to scrutiny.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I highly recommend all of the Guards books and give them a really good go. Try, in fact, the audiobook versions as well, because you might find that listening to them, you can get, if you're someone who doesn't really get into Pratchett through reading them, you might find the audiobooks pull you in.
Yeah.
That was certainly the case with me.
Okay.
With the Guards books. So this is sort of general, not sort of, Madeline, here for your TBR. I want you to read all these books. Okay, so medieval still. Also, I've mentioned the Becca Cooper series by Tamora Pierce before. But there, again, you know, this is slightly more traditional fantasy, but set in a medieval-esque world where the main character is basically a dog, is a police officer. And it's a trilogy of police procedurals. The first one is looking at missing children and also, what was the other thing? Basically, it's two crimes twisted together, but ultimately this missing children is the main thread of it.
Yeah.
The second one is about counterfeiting, which you'd think, God, counterfeiting, really, in a young adult novel? Actually, it's really, really interesting. And then the third one is about slavery.
Oof.
Because Tortle at the time genuinely still has slavery, and suddenly the attitude is kind of like nobody really likes it, but you know, a lot of people are making money out of it, so
yeah,
even the dogs can't do much about it, but people who are being illegally sold, they can definitely interfere.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a plot against the crown, and the young 4-year-old prince is kidnapped and sold as a slave, and they send Becca Cooper and her partner undercover. It's absolutely heartbreaking book, by the way. There's a bit at the end, if you've got really invested in the characters, and it's kind of like, no. There's this really, really, no, there's a really awful sort of, like, her partner who's been almost like a father to her, and bear in mind, you know, she's from a six-child, single-mother family where,
yeah,
you know, she's never really had a father figure, and mm-hmm. he's like an older brother, a father, he helped train her, he was her beat officer when she was just a puppy kind of thing. And well, because they use dogs and puppies, and the kennels is the police station. It's really cool. And it works, trust me. And the thing is, it looks at the idea that, you know, like the Ferengi say, every man has his price.
Mm.
And Tunstall gets bought, and he tries to keep Becca out of it, but they end up having to fight each other.
Oh.
Because she realises that he's the one who's been betraying them all the way through. And it's just, I was like reading it thinking, yeah, but he's going to be good again in a minute, right? You know, and that sort of childish sort of like, this isn't really what I'm reading, is it, kind of way.
No!
it was genuinely awful. But it, again, it's a really good look at human nature, and the fact that having seen so much that is awful and dreadful, and it's kind of eroded parts of your soul, that maybe eventually you might be someone who says, yeah, okay, that is my price.
Yeah.
You know, my morals are not inflexible anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. I think also something which sometimes gets addressed and done very, very well, and sometimes sort of gets forgotten on the wayside, is how traumatic of a job any kind of law enforcement is.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it is traumatic, and I think one of the big main problems is that people are not assessed mentally, because you need to be mentally stable, you know, to be given the responsibility of managing other people who are at their worst, and also certainly to be given the a forceful responsibility where you can enforce things, particularly if you're going to be given a weapon. You need to be mentally stable enough to say, I am not going to panic, I am not going to go off my head with the need for revenge, I'm not going to get needlessly angry and use excessive force. You need someone who has control over their emotions. But the fact of the matter is that if you are there and, you know, you are seeing the worst of humanity constantly, and that you are seeing awful crimes, that you're often dealing with dead bodies or depravity or things like that, that is trauma. That is terrible trauma. Which can cause numerous untold effects, particularly if you just have to deal with it for years and years and years, and you are sort of led to sort of enter a state of mind where you know that nothing you do is ever going to make a difference, and that no matter what you do, it doesn't seem to have changed anything. You can understand why people might, out of, you know, their own minds, in order to protect themselves, might become desensitized.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It's something you find with anyone who works in something like that. Anyway, I've got that as a section for a little bit later, so we'll go into a bit more detail then. But
sorry.
No, that's okay. It was pertinent to what I just said, so it's fine. But other sort of worlds and settings, very briefly, epic fantasy. Madeline's obviously just talked about the Hemartia cycle, which is a good example. And obviously there's also Michelle Segarra's Caste series, which is 15 books long, and I'm on book 9, and I had to have a break because, quite frankly, nothing was happening. As in, they were supposed to be going on a journey from one place to another. This was something that started in book 4, and they're still not there at book 9.
Is it like the Wheel of Time? They get to the end of a book and they've just gotten down the garden path.
Not quite that bad, but it's... I think part of the problem is that this is me picking up books that were written as 90s fantasy by female authors. I really don't want to have a jab at this.
Yeah.
But the problem that a lot of female authors had during the 90s and before was that if they were not writing sex and romance, they had difficulty getting published. So yeah. When you had female authors that then managed to sell a series, a long series like Michelle Segarra's Cast series, or like Kirsten Britton's Green Rider series, which suffers from many of the same problems, is that a load of female readers went, yay, brilliant, female writers, fantasy, yay, picked it up, and really focused on the potential love interest thing. And of course, the authors then, and I know this for a fact with Kirsten Britton, because she's turned around and basically said in very snotty terms to her fans that she does not write romance, and that she's a better author than that, and the thing you should concentrate on is the quality of her fantasy.
Mm.
Which, put a few noses out of joint, put it that way.
Yes.
But, you know, it wasn't just female readers. A lot of people were kind of like, this is great, I want more of this, but I'd like to see more of the romantic subplot. And, you know, people have their ships, and you just have to let them get on with it.
Yeah.
The thing is that I think some of them, in Michelle Segarra's case, she kind of went, well, I don't really want to write that at all, but I also can't kill it dead because I'll lose half of my fan base.
Yeah, that's not good.
And I wouldn't say I'm reading it thinking, wow, I'm waiting for these two to get together, because I honestly couldn't give a shit. But I hate the constant references to it and the fact they keep having the same conversation over and over again. Madeline is probably sat there saying she's being a hypocrite right now. But
no.
But I honestly have to say that, yes, there is a slow burn romance, which is fine, and I am on board with that. I don't mind if you've got a 15-book series. I don't mind if it takes till the middle of the series before the two characters kind of get together. That's a decent time for them to get together. That's kind of like mid a 15-episode series of something on TV. That makes sense. But when it's kind of like you're halfway through and they're kind of like, yeah, we're still talking about it, maybe... It's like, why do you keep bringing it up? Why not focus on the fantasy and have something actually happen on this goddamn journey? But yes, they are police procedurals. It's just in the last 4 books there hasn't been a lot of procedure happening.
Oh dear.
The first few, I'd say the first 3 are worth reading because it's kind of like this dystopian epic fantasy scape, and she's part of the police force and has come from very humble origins, so she didn't start from the wealthy noble degree. She's a human, which is one of the lesser species in that particular world as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, try the first couple. But...
Okay. Thank you for the recommendation.
ones that I've really enjoyed. So sort of historical but recent modern past, mixed with sci-fi because it's time travel.
Yay!
Life on Mars and Ashes to Ashes.
Mm.
Did you watch either of those?
Nope.
I really like, okay, the premise of Life on Mars is that it is 2006 and Sam Tyler is a Greater Manchester police officer who gets hit by a car and wakes up to find himself in 1973.
Oh, that's fun.
Where he has been attached to the police force overseen by DCI Gene Hunt. Gene Hunt is very much from the old school of police officing.
Right.
Policing, rather. Where, and I think what the series does really well is it kind of, you've got this anachronistic, slightly more modern police officer going back 30 years plus in time and realising with horror what policing was like back then. You know, when policemen did carry solid truncheons and genuinely whack people about. Sort of like, oh, you look like a pair of likely lads. What are you up to? We're just smoking outside the pub. Get along with you. Give them a bit of a clip kind of thing.
Yes.
And it's worth understanding that the way policing is done has changed greatly over the last 50 years and before, particularly in even in cities and things where, you know, it was pretty dangerous in the 70s in Manchester and London. So yeah. That's really interesting. And then the Ashes to Ashes kind of follows on, but instead of Sam Tyler, you've got Alex Drake, who is a specialist. She has come from the sort of very wealthy background, got a degree, gone into a specialist type area of the police force. Mm. And she manages to get really, really close to a suspect who then pulls a gun on her and shoots her in the head.
Oh, wow.
And she wakes up in 1982, also attached to DCI Gene Hunt's task force. And he's kind of like, oh, wonderful, we've got dolly knickers with us now. Because there weren't very many women police officers at that point in time.
No.
So in this time, yes, it's also looking at the fact that the police force has, again, moved on in that those 10 years. But now yeah. It's dealing with the sort of the sexism and the gay revolution and the fact that AIDS was becoming prevalent. And it looks at the Falklands War and things like that. And it's and all this pressure, the Thatcherism, the riots. It's really, really fascinating. Hmm. I don't think I got through the last season of Ashes to Ashes because it went a bit, it sort of jumped the shark a little bit, in my opinion. But
right.
But as a comparative sort of like, this is what the early 2000s looked like compared to the 70s and 80s in policing. It's yes. Quite a wake-up call.
It's also, it's amazing because, and I heard this statistic and I have to check it, so don't quote me on this, but, you know, the Met is actually incredibly diverse in terms of sexuality.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think 1982 might have been a bit.
Yes.
You didn't talk about it openly at any workplace.
Yes.
But yeah, definitely. I mean, it's something that I can't speak for forces anywhere else, but certainly in the United Kingdom, these old entrenched coppers who had learned not everything on the street, but were definitely not coming from privileged backgrounds with degrees, etc., but were still damn good police officers in the sense of getting things done, just needed to be taught not to beat the shit out of their suspects.
Yeah. Who'd have thought? But yeah, different times and stuff like that. I'm not, again, when I say different times, I'm not saying therefore it's okay. I'm just saying different times.
No, I think that the timeline of what was acceptable and the fact that they were getting pressure from above to clean up their act because people were complaining is fascinating. So yeah, I'm a big fan of juxtapositions in fiction like that.
Yeah.
And then we go on to sci-fi, proper... proper sci-fi, where I wouldn't say it's uniformly, but certainly in many cases, if you're seeing a police presence and you're not looking at Star Trek-esque utopian future, mm-hmm. where there's no need for the police, you're looking at a military police force, maybe even a secret police force. Now, if you have a police force and someone can put the word secret in front of it, that's a really, really bad sign about the regime you're living in.
It is very, very bad. And it's very, very scary. It makes me think a little bit of... I mean, even with Star Trek, when you get to DS9, you obviously have Bashir, who's super into all these kind of, you know, the old romantic spy sort of stories. And he does end up getting approached by what is essentially like a secret military sort of police force
that operates... Section 31.
Yeah, which is really scary.
Yeah, you're not really... I mean, by the time... Because they show up in other things as well, but by the time you get to DS9, they're not toothless, but they're not as powerful as they once were because there was a point where they could have actually completely taken over the Federation.
Yeah.
I'm showing my nerd stripes here, aren't I? But yeah, it's definitely part of it. I mean, if you think of things like Farscape, which was a 90s Australian-American production in line with Jim Henson, which probably explains some of the puppets and things involved. Sorry, Madden. In terms of its concept, it was incredibly clever at the time. I think it's probably aged a bit now.
Hmm.
But what I like about it was you have Earth Human John Crichton, who is experimenting with wormhole technology, suddenly finds himself catapulted through a wormhole, and in a quadrant of space he doesn't know. where he immediately gets picked up by peacekeepers.
Yeah.
And despite the deceptively soft-sounding name, peacekeepers are not peaceful at all.
No, they don't actually sound that peaceful. It's the keepers that
It's a sort of totalitarian state, so a little bit like you get in Firefly, which is more sort of Law of the West in many ways, but with this huge overreaching government controlling basically monopolies of planets and things. But in Farscape, it's kind of, yeah, there are pockets of resistance and things, but most of us try and toe the line because, you know, they have all the power that, you know, they have. This is what happens when you allow a militaristic police state to keep going and you don't challenge a totalitarian regime and it keeps going, and suddenly you find that actually all your freedoms have been curtailed.
Yeah.
This is China in space kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting, and it was the fact that one of the people he ends up meeting is Erin Sung, who is to this day one of the most badass female science fiction characters I've ever encountered. And she doesn't like him. For a start, he's human, therefore he's like beneath her notice.
Mm.
And she's, because the peacekeepers they look human, but they're actually slightly reptilian.
Right.
They're cold-blooded.
That says a lot.
Says a lot, doesn't it? Yeah, it's a little bit of an obvious metaphor these days. But she goes on such an interesting character arc, because she was picked and chosen as a child and then trained from sort of 10 years old upwards to be a peacekeeper. So she's never wanted to be anything else.
Mm.
All she's wanted to be is the best peacekeeper she can be. And meeting Crichton kind of challenges things and makes her think about things, and she ends up, through no fault of her own initially, a renegade to the peacekeepers.
Mm.
And she starts off wanting to go back and being someone that absolutely cannot be trusted, because she wants to go back to the life she's known.
Yeah.
And after a while, she's kind of like, okay, I've met a lot of other people and a lot of other species now, and I don't actually think the peacekeepers are superior. And maybe, just maybe, I was one of the bad guys.
Are we the bad guys, huh?
Yeah, classic like that. So it's really good, and it's a really interesting character study. Some of the effects and things, again, are a little bit dated, but it was the early 90s, so... You know, we didn't have good CGI back then.
Yes. Indeed. They were trying.
And then you've got things like Judge Dredd and RoboCop, which on one hand are pull and slightly Bormian, on the other are kind of like, oh god, that, you know, please don't let that be what we're heading towards.
Yes.
It's like, we'll invest a load in very, very small target police groups who then have the power to be judge, jury, and executioner. This is not good.
No, that's terrifying.
Admittedly, both of those are kind of, you know, they're very much saying, this is not how we should do things, whilst doing it that way, in order so that we go, no, that's terrible, no, that's a really bad idea.
I've noticed on the list, you have not added urban fantasy.
No, I have not added urban fantasy.
Which, for me, feels a bit strange.
Well, it's because most urban fantasy is private investigator, and we weren't talking about private investigators.
This is true. It is usually private investigator, but they do usually have a police force sort of working with them at the same time. But I can appreciate your point.
Yeah, we absolutely can do. I've got the police popping up at various intervals in Harker and Blackthorn.
You do, yes.
I've tried to make them unhelpful, but unhelpful for the right reasons, in the sense of, no, this does not fall within our remit, and you're acting suspicious, therefore you are under suspicion, rather than, oh, it's the dummy cops getting in the way again, which you kind of get in some of the older urban fantasy.
Yeah, I have that also with Kestrel, which... I'm not going into too much detail, but obviously Kestrel does have a few run-ins with various law enforcements of various kinds. They do actually have, within the magical community, they do have people on the inside of the police force who are there when there's some magical crap going on to just kind of take over and just help sort of cover it up, as it were, and just sort of not doctor the paperwork, but just say instead of it was a large rampaging, I don't know, minotaur, it was a rampaging bull kind of thing instead. Yeah. And yeah, Kestrel, there's a character in the series who that's his job, and he is human. And he really doesn't like this job because he especially wants to actually make a difference in people's lives. He hates corruption of any kind. And now he's part of a system which is not really corruption, because it sort of does need to be done, but he doesn't like sort of working within it. And of course, he really dislikes working with Kestrel, who operates on a completely different level to him.
Yeah. I think it's always interesting when you've got a character who is, particularly if it's a main character, who is magical in some way.
Yeah.
And then you have to partner them at least partially with someone who is human and knows that there's magic out there, or has had to come to that horrible realisation. Laura Laksu does it in her Wild Investigation series, but you've got Yennia Wild, who is running she's a private investigator, but she, you know, you've got Old London, which is sort of the magical community, and New London, which is basically the humans. Mm-hmm. And you have the human police force. And I can't remember the name of the human police officer, but he ends up working with her and she's kind of his contact. But she's always slightly uncomfortable because he so very clearly wants to be magical.
Yeah.
I don't know where that's going, but I feel like maybe Laura is going to make that a bone of contention in the future, and I kind of can't wait. So I'm up for that one. And also, you know, the early Dresden Files, you have Karen Murphy, who is a good cop. She's good at her job. And, you know, gives Harry a lot of shit because she doesn't believe in wizards. Why should she at that point in time?
Yeah, she does. I like that she doesn't believe in wizards, but she knows there's something up, so she'll have Harry in.
Yeah.
As it were. But, yeah, and then she kind of has a bit of a rude awakening and has to sort of look at the reality of certain things.
Yeah, so it's actually very like the police force as you see them in comic books as well, which I suppose with a lot of comic books are kind of urban fantasy or urban science fiction.
Yeah. Well, it's that I always think about the poor police force in Gotham.
Wouldn't you just go, okay, which one of us has to light the lamp tonight? And they're all kind of like drawing straws because no one wants to deal with this shit.
It's just like who lights the lamp? And they all just look at Commissioner Gordon. He's like, all right.
Fine, every time.
But he's really rude.
He's rude, and something's going to get trashed, and I am not taking the heat for it this time.
Yeah. And I do also like that. I mean, I gave up on the series Gotham. I just couldn't keep watching it. I started it, and eventually I just had to stop. But they did actually address the fact that, as with, you know, a city which has that much crime and that much corruption in it, it was inevitable that the police were also corrupt as well.
Yeah.
Within it, which is kind of why Batman has to operate, because the police are really inefficient because they're part of the whole criminal process.
Interesting aside, but during the height of the, I think, when was this, roughly sort of late 80s, early 90s, that the really big rush of the drug trade in South America, they found out that statistically basically 8 out of 9 of every police group of police officers were on the take.
Yeah.
And generally the 9th, the one that wasn't, ended up dead somewhere.
Yeah.
The only way to survive was to be on the take. And it was just, it wasn't a case of are you corrupt, it was how far up the chain of corruption do you go?
Yeah.
It's terrifying. Seriously, Google it. Look for the statistics. And it's just sort of, oh my god, why would you go into that line of work? But I suppose once you're in, that's it. You know stuff and you can't get out.
Yeah. It's like the mafia.
Yeah. Okay, so final thing to look at, some of the themes, good guys or bad guys?
Yeah. So, as I said, police, there was a lot of propaganda, and this is the bit that always gets me, is that there was this big sort of move towards making the police out to be the heroes and the good guys, which happened at the same time where lawyers and stuff were always made out to be the bad guys, and reporters yeah. as well. Those meddling reporters and those meddling lawyers. How dare they question things?
Yeah, definitely. The thing... I'm not talking of any specific police force, but this is things to consider with your police force in your book or with books you're reading or whatever. Any large organisation will attract people who are ill-intentioned because that seems the best environment to shelter them and their proclivities. So without going into too much detail, the way the Catholic Church always seems to have priests who are paedophiles, this is not the case of all priests are paedophiles at all. This is a case of the Catholic Church provides an environment where it's easy for them to live that kind of double life.
Yeah.
So that they can do what they want to do. And certain branches of the police force in whatever country you're in will attract basically right-wing nut jobs or people who want to bully or beat other people because it provides an environment where they can indulge in that. And the real knack, I think, is changing things so that it's no longer a welcome environment for people like that.
Yeah.
And things obviously are changing because 70s police force in the UK would definitely have taken on people who were sort of hit thieves rather than question them. And now it's very much not like that.
Yeah. Though, that's not always the case in other countries.
No, absolutely not.
Recent events might have shown.
yeah. But basically, in and of themselves, the idea isn't that they're not evil. It's just that they are people, and people can be both good and bad and everything in between.
Yeah. And that any position which offers a modicum of power or accessibility to people who are weaker than you will attract some evil people.
Yeah, or, you know, people who want to be able to exploit power over someone else. Yeah. I mean, that I've actually read some transcripts of why people join the police force in America, admittedly, where they've said that they actually wanted to be in that sort of position of authority. And it's chilling stuff to read, it really is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, broken windows policing. I'm assuming most people know what I mean, but basically it's the idea that if you fix the broken windows on a street, then you raise the tone of the neighbourhood and therefore you get less crime, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
The theory is actually from, I think, 1972, something like that, perhaps a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
But it was actually put into practice well before the phrase was coined in about 1965 in Hell's Kitchen in New York. They decided they were going to clean up the area. And they did this by using this thing. So basically, even really, really small petty crimes were punished very, very harshly.
Yeah.
And it did. Their statistics looked amazing. It looked like crime had just completely dropped. I won't go through all of them. The problem was that it wasn't addressing the underlying issues, and it allowed a platform to occur whereby certain groups were profiled as being more likely to commit crime. And that's something that then fed into, let's say, the institutionalised racism of a particular area. So ultimately, it doesn't really work. I mean, yes, if everybody cared about a neighbourhood, then they would do things to ensure that it was kept up and that less crime was committed there. But you do that by bringing people on to make them part of a team. So, yeah. I mean, as Madeline has shown in her most extreme version, where she has people out eating each other if they're breaking curfew, that's basically broken windows policing. That's kind of like, you did this, therefore this is you steal a loaf of bread, you go to hard labour for 20 years. It's insane. It's not the punishment of fitting the crime.
Yeah. And I mean, this is, and there are real life examples of this, you know, throughout history as well. So you have the Hell's Kitchen one, but you also have, I mean, Vlad Dracula, when he was, when he was ruling Wallachia,
I think you mean Vlad Tepish.
Sorry, Vlad, not... Well, I mean, he was... Sorry, Vlad Dracul, so the... He was called Dracula because it meant the son of Dracul, who was his father. But yeah, so I'll call him Vlad Tepes to avoid any kind of confusion. So Vlad Tepes, when he was the ruler of Wallachia, did have this thing where any crime, you just got put on a spike. Steal something, on a spike. Murder someone, on a spike. Everybody, on a spike. And that is not just a death penalty. That is not just a death penalty. That is an extremely painful, awful, horrific way to die. And also an awful thing to witness. And yeah, so crime dropped very, very rapidly in Wallachia. But for very obvious reasons, he wasn't particularly popular.
I think the interesting thing would have been if somebody had done a statistical sampling at the time, found out whether crime was actually dropping or people were just getting better at covering it up.
Yeah.
Because that's largely what was happening in Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah.
So the, you know, the statistics were very, very off because the numbers won't lie, but people who gather numbers definitely can do, and they are subject to confirmation bias. So
yeah.
It's that there's an episode of... Star Trek The Next Generation, where all rules are punished by death, so all laws, broken laws are punished by death, and they're at this planet and they're admiring how much peace there is, and Will goes off and plays ball with some kids, and there's a sign saying keep off the grass or something, and the ball goes on the grass, and Will doesn't read the sign and runs to get the ball, and then finds he's on trial for his life.
Yeah, and they literally just say, just come with us, and everyone's like, oh, bad luck. And I'm like, no, they're gonna execute him because he missed a sign. Yeah.
It's like it doesn't work. That is basically your broken windows policing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the idea in itself wasn't wrong, but the way it was executed was very, very bad. And it's really interesting to see that explored in science fiction and fantasy.
Yeah.
And, yeah, this is what we were talking about earlier. Any organisation that deals with humanity as a whole will see the best and worst of it.
Yeah.
And will contain people who start off with the best of intentions and they want to protect and serve, and they become worn down and jaded, and it literally just sort of erodes your soul. This happens to people in the NHS as well. I've seen this happen with nurses, where it gets to a point where, in order to keep themselves together, they've kind of taught themselves to stop caring about the individual as much.
Yeah. And it's awful, because we like to think of, no, why can't you show some empathy? And fail to understand that these people are so overworked for the trauma that they are receiving. And perhaps if, you know, there was less trauma involved, perhaps if there were more nurses or more police, or that there was a higher rate of rotation, which allowed people to recover from traumatic experiences, or, you know, sufficient enough support, that wouldn't happen. But again, it is a survival technique. And it's not necessarily because a person is bad or anything along those lines at all. Our brains literally can only deal with a certain amount of trauma before we have they sort of have to shut down certain bits in order to protect themselves. And if that keeps continuously happening, brain chemistry will be altered. So you could have someone who was not necessarily a bad person, someone who actually was good and had all of the best intentions, and they can still be run down to sort of believe in a world where basically they say, well, you know what, I might as well take some money and look the other way here, because at this point that it doesn't make a damn bit of a difference.
Yeah, no one gives a shit. Everybody's doing it. I think the key is, the problem is these jobs are very demanding. You can end up working 12 to 15 hour shifts or longer. I know doctors who've worked almost 20 hours at a stretch, which is appalling.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't make anybody do that. That's insane.
Yeah, particularly if you want someone to be at their best. Because it's kind of what you want a doctor to be at.
And the problem is, it's impossible under those conditions to have work-life balance. So you're working in something like the NHS, or you're working in the police force, and you're working these really long hours, and you're supposed to have a break where you get to eat and sleep and socialise with other people and see that actually your job and what you do and what you deal with is focused on quite a narrow section of humanity and the rest of it is actually not like that at all. But because it becomes your whole world, all you see, your entire world, is made up of these awful things.
Yeah. And remember, it is, we are automatically wired to remember the bad things above the good things.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm just going to make a point here, which is that this is obviously shown in extreme when it comes to social workers, when it comes to the police, when it comes to, you know, anyone who's working with people when they're at their worst. It's also shown in teachers as well, to a Absolutely. Much smaller degree. But teachers, you would not believe the hours that teachers put in. You would not believe the extra work that they have to do, which they're not paid to do. And everyone always imagines teachers have these amazingly long holidays without considering the fact that most of that holiday is spent marking and planning and having to jump through a number of hoops, and that work-life balance is not great. This is particularly in the UK. Teaching is a really, really difficult job. And you get through a class, you see all these young people, and then it's gone, and it's another class, and it's another group of people, and it's over and over and over again, and sometimes things happen that sort of break your heart, and it becomes repetitive, and you can get to the point where you're like, I actually have to sort of protect myself at this point by cutting off and saying, what can I give of myself here? Because I've already given so much. How much more of myself can I give? And so having a verbal response at the end of even just people saying, thank you so much, I really enjoyed that, it can make the biggest difference. And again, I'm only talking about things on a tiny scale, but I know that last semester, and I don't want to go off on too much of a tangent, so I do apologise, but last semester, and this one which will be coming up, but last semester, obviously, because of COVID, all of the teaching that I was doing was completely changed. It was a really tough, tough environment. It was tough for me, it was really tough for the students. There was an incredible amount of extra work that needed to be done and will continue to need to be done, which has been very taxing to the point of complete mental exhaustion. And one of the only things that really got me through it was the fact that at the end of the day, I would have these amazing students who were also going through such a difficult time turning around and saying thank you and seeing that a difference has been made, that a positive difference has been made, that it's not just kind of an endless grind where nothing ever seems to change. So I'm very fortunate in that. And I think that the way that social workers and the police and anyone else, and doctors and nurses go through those things without necessarily having that positive confirmation, because this is the other thing, is that doctors don't necessarily get to see their patients the whole way through the process. I get to see my students the whole way through the process, but a doctor might only be there at your worst point, and they might not see you again in the recovery, you know, recovery following up. Nurse might not see you then. Everything just goes and rushes quickly, and so you see the bad things, you don't see the good.
Yeah, and it certainly can be like that. And you know what I will say is, anything where you get an injury, you sustain an injury and it doesn't get time to heal properly, and then you get an injury again, probably in the same place, and again and again, and eventually you build up scar tissue, and that's the same for psychological and you know, emotional injuries as for anything else. Scar tissue is inflexible. So to use this metaphor, abuse it even, it gets to the point where you stop being able to see in a different way. Which I think is, it can be what happens with certain police officers. The ones who I know personally who have managed to avoid this are the ones who have managed to find something else outside to live for as well, and maintain a certain amount of balance.
And again, we are not talking about the people who came into the police force without good intentions. I just want to make that entirely clear. We're not talking about people who came in with the intention of abusing power or with that kind of mindset. We are talking about everyday people who might have all of the best intentions and can still end up being corrupted. And this doesn't excuse any terrible behaviour that they do commit. It's just about understanding how that happens.
Yeah, definitely. So, to finish off, we'll talk just 2 minutes about our favourite police-type characters in fiction.
You go first.
We've probably got some of the same ones. Annoyingly, I can't remember the name of one of the guys I really like. He's a Catholic Liverpudlian from Phil Rickman's Merrily Watkins series. And I feel sorry for this poor sod, because every time Merrily, the priest's name, comes up, he's kind of like, oh shit, it's going to be supernatural shit, isn't it? I'm not supposed to believe in this. I'm a police officer, for God's sake. But he's great. He's really, really good. Who else? I do like Karen Murphy.
Yeah.
She's not utilised to the best extent, in my opinion, but I like her as a character.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
I loved Alex Drake in Ashes to Ashes because, you know, she's walking into this seething cesspool of sexism and she just brushes it all off by kind of out-poshing them all.
Yeah.
She just makes them feel like misbehaving little boys.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, I've got to say, I'm a big fan of Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Putting aside all of the implications of liking a police drama, I do love Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I like the dynamic. I like the characters. I love Holt. I love Jake. I just really, really like those characters. I used to be really super into The Mentalist as well.
I think I watched the first season of that and it was okay, but we sort of didn't continue.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And as I said, I like Elementary. I like Gregson in Elementary. I think he's a good character. And obviously I've always been a big fan of Poirot. So I like Japp, who appears in Poirot. And who sort of just, over time, just sort of goes along with what Poirot says. So, yeah. There are lots of very, very good characters. And, yeah, I just think it will continue to be an incredibly strong genre, which should be challenged, I agree, and elements of it should be challenged. But I think it just has too many things going for it to just disappear.
I mean, I think the interesting thing, oh, before I say what I was about to say, Luther with Idris Elba, just like,
ooh, yeah,
amazing, really, really good. Yeah, I think the interesting thing with the sort of mashup of sci-fi, fantasy and police procedural will be whether the changes that's made in the fictional universes and things,
mm-hmm,
starts to be reflected in nature, because it's weird how that happens.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So that's the thing. If you're writing something like that, maybe think about writing about how you would like it to be and see a police force changing, and you might find that that starts to be reflected in the
Write it
world.
Into reality, people.
Write it into reality.
This is why everything's so awful at the moment. Everyone was writing dystopia and now reality's reflecting it. Write nice things, people.
Yeah, see, all those people are like, yeah, dystopian fiction is over. And what they were really saying was, no, it needs to be over, otherwise something really bad's going to happen.
Stop writing dystopia. You're
Don't
making it real.
Plague fiction.
Yes. So there we have it. What about you guys? What are some of your favourite police characters or law enforcement characters in fantasy or in fiction? Let us know. Do you agree with what we've said or do you disagree? We'd love to hear from you. Remember, you can get in touch with us via Twitter or Facebook or Tumblr, both individually or through our Dissecting Dragons page. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons... Let's try that again. Before you go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week, and this week, Jules, I believe you've got one for us.
Yes, nothing to do with the police force at all.
Hooray!
I recently got around to reading The Brightsiders by Jen Wilde, and it's pretty fluffy. It's got some gritty themes, but it is kind of wish fulfillment.
Excellent.
Contemporary young adult, and it's great. I really, really enjoyed it. It basically charts the journey of this LGBTQ punk rock band of teenagers who are almost at the point of making it to the big time. And the main character M, is kind of going through a tough time. She's got these awful, emotionally abusive, gaslighting parents. Oof. And has not been able to really process that in herself. She's got a very manipulative, again, gaslighting girlfriend. And the whole thing is kind of about her learning to appreciate herself and learn that she doesn't need to do these stupid things that are kind of ruining her life just to make other people like her, people
yeah.
who will love her for her. And sometimes it's a little bit on the nose, but you know what? I was reading it thinking, no, this is really sweet, and I don't mind the fact that it's kind of trumpeting what it's saying.
Hmm.
So, yeah, and the whole idea of, yes, you've kind of made it to the big time with your talent, etc., that's all very wish-fulfillment-y, but thinking about the audience it's probably written for, it wasn't written for a woman in her early 40s, presumably, and yet I still managed to really enjoy it. So.
That's great. Sometimes we just need fluffy wish-fulfillment things.
We do, and, you know, every member of this band is either bi or pansexual. And
I can get behind that.
One of them is genderqueer as well, so.
Excellent.
It was done nicely. It's a really, really cute book.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. All right, guys. On that note, we'll say thanks very much for listening. Keep safe, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.